We're going back to the beginning of Perek Yitzayin. And last week we went through last week we went through the story of Pelegesh Begiva, sorry, of Pesach Micha, which is really two stories in one. One story is the piece about Micha's idol, which he builds or creates a temple out of the golden, out of the silver idol which his mother made from the money that Micha had stolen from her. Complicated, convoluted story. And that turns into a temple, which turns into a idolatrous center for an hotel and bed and breakfast and center for Bnei Ephraim, 4 kilometers from Shiloh.
I was there.
From Shiloh, not a Pesach Micha.
Shiloh, no, I didn't see Pesach Micha.
Right. And the other part of the story is Shevet Dan and their migration from the coast region where they were originally given territory all the way up north into the Golan Heights, where because they couldn't get a foothold or a stronghold on the coast, so they head north into the Golan, and along the way they steal Micha's idol and his Levi, whom he had charged with being his kohen, and there they create this new center for religious life. The this Pesach Micha now becomes a center for Shevet Dan. And this Levi became the central figure of this temple, promoted from the status of Levi to the status of idolatrous Kohen, which is quite a promotion. And there, if you do, we'll just take a quick glance at the end of Perek Yud-Chet, just to get a sense of how the story concludes. Pasuk Chavtet, let's say. Vayikru'u shem ha'ir Dan b'shem Dan avihem. They called the name of the city Dan after their father, their ancestry, the Shevet Dan, New Dan, as we affectionately called it. Ashi yulad l'Yisrael. V'ulam Laish shem ha'ir l'vishana. City originally called Laish. Vayakimu lahem b'nei Dan et ha-pasel. In addition to establishing a new city, they built this pesel. They took this pesel and they established it, they fixed it there. V'yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe hu vanav hayu kohanim l'shevet ha-dani ad yom glot ha-aretz. Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe, together with the sons, together with the were serving as kohanim through Shevet Dan until Israel was exiled. Israel was exiled means that this temple of Dan will stay there for many years. V'yasimu lehem pesel micha asher asah kol yemei heyot beit ha'elokim b'shilo. This pesel stood in this place in parallel to and all the days that the Mishkan, God's house, stood in Shiloh. So really there are two stories here. The minor piece of, or the beginning of the story, which is really the background to the second piece, which is the relationship between Micha, his mother, and the establishment of the idol. And the second piece is Shevet Dan's migration and how they take this idolatrous temple, steal it, and take it up north. Both of these stories bracketed, or introduced, if you will, by a phrase which we will spend some time discussing in part today and in part later in the session. Both of these stories bracketed by the phrase "Bayamim ha'em ein melech b'Yisrael ish ha'yashar bein havyasi," which in itself requires some explanation. What does it mean when it says that there's no king in Israel? How did we get into a conversation about kings if we're in the book of Shoftim? Where does that fit into the picture? That in itself is a conversation we will have to have, and we will so do so momentarily. Does everybody have a copy of the source page from last week?
No.
What did I give you last week? Just the chart? Just the chart? Okay, just the chart. Just the chart?
Yes, just the chart.
Anybody doesn't have, I'll give you that one. Just the chart. So I will give you, that's the chart. Let's just keep one for me. The rest are available.
I think you have many.
I have many, many. This is the other source page that I want you to have for today. So we'll take that and pass it down. So from the outset, before we begin our a look at some of the sources, based on what we read through and learned through this story last week, and a little bit that I summarized this morning, there are a couple of odd things about the story that stand out from a perspective of, well, there's lots of odd things about the story, but from the perspective of the Book of Shoftim that we've been learning. In other words, if I put this story into the canvas of Sefer Shoftim as a whole, there are a number of immediate oddities that stand out. One already mentioned, which is this reference to Ein Melech B'Yisrael. How did we get to a conversation about Melech when we're in the Book of Shoftim? Besides that, however, there's another oddity, or another somewhat what strikes us as strange, different, out of character from from the rest of the book in this story.
You said it wasn't. They sinned, and then...
Did we talk about this last week?
You mentioned it, yes.
We mentioned, okay. the fact that there's no shofet in this story. There's no... None of the patterns that we are familiar with from the rest of the story appear in this context. If you will, it's almost like the opening phrase of every other iteration was Vayas Bnei Yisrael Hara B'nei Hashem. They did evil, idolatry, etc. It's kind of like a snapshot of what that means. If I were to take a magnifying glass, sort of zoom in, what does it mean, Lasot Hara B'nei Hashem? What is the idolatry that we're talking about? This story kind of gives us a glimpse into the culture of the world of idolatry without the rest of the story. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that there's a certain aspect of the story that leads like this. Vayas hara be'enei Hashem. Pick a shofet, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Any of them. Yiftach, Abniel,
Gidon.
Right, any of them. World of idolatry. Vayas hara be'enei Hashem. As an introduction to each one of the shoftim. And then suddenly we have this kind of glimpse, as if I sort of, in the world of hyperlinks, I went like this. Okay, what does Vayasa Rabbi Nei Hashem mean? Right, and suddenly you say, okay, here's a big story. Let's call it Pesel Micha. That seems to describe nothing but this idolatry that we are talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, whether in fact the story is brought here or taught or included to convey the evil of Israel or a positive characteristic of Israel, we'll see. But either way, it certainly has this sense that its focus is on the idolatry of the people and not on any other historical context, not on the enemy, not on the shofet, not on the war, not on the battles, nothing related to the themes that we have seen up until now. The exercise could have been done the other way around. If you think about all of the different genres that we have discussed in the course of our study of Shoftim for the last 3 years, if you just brainstorm all of the different pieces of the stories that we've had, an enemy, a battle, a shofet, idolatry, a mourning by God, a cycle. After the shofet dies, they return to their evil ways of or to their backsliding into idolatry. If you go through all of the different pieces, you see clearly that none of them appear in the story of Pesel Micha. Really quite out of the ordinary in that regard. And that really dovetails into the question of what does the phrase "Bayim Mahim Ein Melech BeYisrael" mean? So I parked that question, and if you look at the first page that I've given you, that I gave you last week, there are extras here if anybody doesn't have. There are two charts, the top and the middle. The chart in the middle is this enigmatic phrase that appears four times at the end of the Sefer. Both in the context of Pilegesh, of Pesel Micho, and its corollary story of Shevet Dan, and Perek Yud Tet and Pesel Chof Aleph, and Perek Chof Aleph. The last two references are the beginning and end of the next story, which is Pilegesh Begiva. We haven't looked at Pilegesh Begiva, but already I'll tell you, Pilegesh Begiva, like Pesel Micho, it's a story. It also lacks any of the context genre that we have seen in Sefer Shoftim. Like Pesel Micha, it's a story that stands by itself. There's no shofet. There's no battle. There's no enemy. There's no description of the cycle that we have been familiar with. And so that really connects to the first chart at the top of the page, which is a summary of Sefer Shoftim, divided into two parts. That's essentially the conclusion that we came to at the end of last week, that Sefer Shoftim is really two books and one or two parts to the book. The first, you could even argue three parts if you included chapter one, because chapter one also was a kind of introduction. Do you remember anything about chapter one? What was Nigva chapter one? Chapter one was a list of all the tribes, where they conquered and where they didn't. And it's really a holdover from Sefer Yehoshua. In fact, many of the stories in chapter 1 are really connected to Sefer Yehoshua. It's kind of an introduction to the book and sets the stage for the fact that there's all these Canaanite strongholds both within and enemies around that Israel is threatened by throughout the book of Shoftim. Then we start from chapter 2 all the way through to chapter 16. We have various episodes along the same cyclical pattern set out for us in the introduction in chapter 2 when the Navi comes and says, right, here's what's going to happen. And we had all the various Shoftim that we've studied over the last 2 years. Otniel ben Knaz, Ehab ben Gera, Shemgar, Devar, Gidon, Avimelech, Tolu, Yair, Yiftach, Yiftzan, Elon, Avdon, and Shimshon. Some we spent more time on, some we spent less time on. And then the second part of the story, which is really almost like an epilogue to the book, is these two episodes of Pesel Micha and Pilegesh Begiva, Bayim Mahem Ein Melech BeYisrael, Ish Yashar Bein Av Ya'asa. That leads to one of the biggest debates in the Mefarshim as to how to understand this story, based on the fact that there's such a disconnect from the historical context of this event from the previous components of the Sefer, that it begs the question to what does the Navi mean in the phrase Bayamim Ahem? To what are we referring when we say Bayamim Ahem Ein Melech BeYisrael? In those days, which days are we talking about? To which days are we referring when we say there was no king in Israel, and as if to say that that somehow connects to the substance of the story that that we have been looking at? And here the Mefarshim divide up into two fundamental different schools that will change dramatically the meaning of the story. Not only the significant components of the story itself, but also the purpose for which this story is included in Sefer Shoftim. So we really need to understand these two positions in order to get a proper grip on what the message of this part of the Sefer is about. And because this part of the Sefer is probably the two most dramatic stories in the whole book, this is a very important component of our understanding of Sefer Shoftim. So with that introduction in mind, I'm going to go to the second source page that I gave you.
we're going to add this because there's no authority. There's no authority to prevent such things happening. Help prevent.
If you understand the phrases by Mima of Ein Melech as no authority, meaning anarchy, then, or control, then that's possible. But again, it becomes a question of to which days are we referring will impact what the phrase Ein Melech means.
But I thought last week you said Ein Melech, Melech was a shofet,
yeah.
And a melech.
Well, we're going to see. Okay. That's exactly the debate.
Yeah.
That's exactly the debate. And I want to show it to you inside because it goes to the whole sense of what this story is about. So let's start actually did we go through the Rashi Radak last week? No, we did not.
Mm-mm.
All right, so let's start with the let's start with Baal Seder Olam. Let's start with source 2. I'll come back to Rashi, but we first need to see the basis upon which the discussion revolves. Source number 2 is a quote from a Midrash referred to as Seder Olam, or Seder Olam Rabbah. Seder Olam is a very important Midrashic work. It's a chronology of all of the events in Tanakh. Essentially, all of our traditional rabbinic interpretation of biblical events and the dates, the length of time each one takes, all come from Seder Olam. Rashi builds his chronology of Tanakh and his understanding of the chronology of Tanakh primarily on the basis of the Medrash and Seder Olam. It was written by Atana. Significant interpretations such as the 400 years that we were in Egypt was really only 210, because we backdate the start of the 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak in order to resolve some of the textual issues related to our existence, our sojourn in Egypt, comes from Baal Seder Olam. The length of the age of Yitzchak at the Akedah as being 12 years old comes from the story of the Akedah. The identity of Rivka as being 3 years old because of the length of the calculations of all the times related to Yitzchak, also in the birth of Rivka at the time of the Akedah, all of these midrashic interpretations of the chronology of events in Chumash come from this midrash. It's in sequence of Tanakh. It goes through Tanakh and goes through all of the events and identifies exactly what happens when. It gives us our dating system. To a large extent, our date, 5772, which is a calculation of all of the events post-Tanakh back through the events of Tanakh, are based on the chronological interpretation of Tanakh as expressed through Baal Seder Olam. So it really is a very important source for us.
It goes all the way back to the creation of the world.
It starts in the beginning of Chumash. Or at least the beginning of Adam HaRishon. Says the Baal Seder Olam, "Bimei Kushan Rishataim haya pislo shel Micha." This pesel of Micha stood in the days of Kushan Rishataim. Who is Kushan Rishataim? Nope. It's the name of a king. There's a place called Kush, which in modern Hebrew is identified as Ethiopia. In Tanakh, it's not Ethiopia at all. In Tanakh, the name Kush, as a place, is a reference to the southern half of the continent of Africa. Africa as a whole is divided into two parts. The northern half of Africa is called Mitzrayim. The southern half of the African continent is referred to as Kush. Mm. That's essentially the biblical terminology. In modern Hebrew, Kush is referred to as Ethiopia. But Kushan Rishataim is a name. A name of whom? Well, Rishataim means like doubly evil.
Right.
Kushan Rishataim is an old nemesis. An old nemesis. Like Dennis the Menace. Right? in Lahavdil Kishan Rishatayim with Dennis the Menace. But he's an old nemesis. Why old nemesis? I'll fill in the phrase. Kushan Rishatayim Melech Aram Naharaim.
The king of Aram.
King of Aram Naharaim, which puts us where? Chronologically? No. Yeah, it's true. Avram had experience in Aram Naharaim. But that's not where Kushan Rishatayim comes from. Kushan Rishatayim. It's a good review of Sefer Shoftim here. Perek Gimel. Oh.
Too long ago.
Pasuk Zayin. Vayasu b'nei Yisrael atara b'nei Hashem, vayishkechu et Hashem alakehem, vayavdu et ha-ba'alim ve et ha-asherot. Israel did evil in the eyes of God. They worshipped Baal, they worshipped Asherot, they worshipped different idols. Vayichar af Hashem b'Yisrael. God got angry at Israel. Vayimkerem b'yad Kushan Rishatayim. He sold them into the hands of Kushan Rishatayim, Melech Aram Naharaim. Vayavdu b'nei Yisrael et Kushan Rishatayim shmona shanim. They paid tribute, served Kushan Rishatayim for 8 years. Vayizaku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem. They cried out to God. Vayakam Hashem Moshiach livnei Yisrael v'yoshiim. Israel sent them their first shofet by the name of Et Otniel ben Knaz Achi Kalev Hakaton Mimenu. Otniel ben Knaz.
Ladi Yichus,
brother of Kalev, younger brother. Batiel Avruach Hashem Ishpotet Yisov Eitzel Mechama. Ruach Hashem judged Israel, went to war. Beiten Hashem Biadot Kushan Rishatayim Melech Aram conquers Kushan Rishatayim or drives him away, has the upper hand. Vataz Yado Al Kushan Rishatayim. Vatishkot Aretz 40 Shana Veyamot Otniel ben Knaz. Land was quiet for 40 years. Otniel ben Knaz dies, and we're into the next iteration, which is Eil ben Gera. Otniel ben Knaz is the Yichus of being the very first Shofet in the book.
They sure use that phrase a few times in those few sentences.
Which one? Which phrase?
Kushan Rishatayim. Yeah, the Kushan
Rishatayim.
It's his name.
I know, but I mean, it's a lot in 3 lines.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. We actually talked about that way back when we studied Kusha, the story of Otniel ben Knaz. We talked about why he was so evil, this Kushan Rishatayim. But I'll leave that for the tapes. It's recorded and on the internet. So if you want
he's
to,
really evil, but he has the merit of because we were doing Ra, that we are sold to him.
Well, that's true with all the iteration. Right? Somewhere along the line, we as punishment, we ended up being sold or under the political forces or autonomy.
I was wondering, when we're sold to some entity, does that mean they have merit or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, but it's not necessarily. Haman, I'm not sure I would go there. I'm not sure I would go. But be that as it may, in our context of Pesach Micha, by the Medrash suggesting that this story took place in the days of Kushan Rishatayim, what Chazal are really pointing to is the very first time we have any reference to Bnei Yisrael worshipping idols in this book. That is the time frame in which we are going to put the story of Pesach Micha.
Yeah. Of course.
It also raises the question of why wasn't it included in the original, if it took place during that time?
Why wasn't it written there?
Right.
It's a fair question. I'm hoping, I'm assuming that by the time we get to the end of the story, that question will be answered. If it isn't, then
I'll remind you.
Remind me, write it down. As I tell my students, write it down. As I tell my students in class, write it down, and if I don't get back to it, remind me.
It's not going to happen. Unless somebody else does.
No, we might get to it today. So the first interpretation, which is Baal Seit Na'olam, is that we are in the time frame of Kushan Rishatayim, which is essentially the time frame of Otniel ben Knaz. And that takes the whole story and puts it early, which means that we are moving the story chronologically from the end of the book back to the beginning of the book. Full circle. Full circle. What's the proof to that suggestion? It's really a remarkable and astounding suggestion, considering the fact that the book heretofore has been written very chronologically and very sequentially. There's no textual reference to the beginning of chapter 17 to indicate to me that we have shifted our chronological structure. We go from the end of Shimshon directly to Vayhi Ish Mihar Ephraim Ushmo Michayu. So where do Chazal see the early dating of this story? So here the Medrash continues and says, how do I know that this is an early story? Shene Emar. Here's a pasuk. Vayakimu lehem b'nei Dan et ha-pasah kol yemei hayot beit elokim b'shilo. Last pasuk in Perek Yud Chet.
Where are you reading?
I'm in the Medrash in source number 2.
Yeah.
Vayakimu lehem b'nei Dan et ha-pasah kol yemei hayot beit elokim b'shilo. That is the last pasuk in Perek Yud Chet. I read it a few minutes ago. That this pestle that the Shevet Dan stole and put into their new home in Shevet, in the Golan Heights. Anybody here been to Tel Dan?
Mm-hmm.
So you know where the area is. You know where the area is. That stood all the days of Beit Elokim B'Shilo. How does that tell me, says the Medrash, that this story is so early it goes back to the days of Otniel ben Knas? What's the connection? It's a non sequitur. How did I get from a phrase that says that this pestle stood in Dan all the days that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh? How do I get from that phrase to the suggestion that this episode took place 350 years before this particular location in Sefer Shoftim?
I'm going to say Midrash.
Well, it is a medrash, but I want to understand the medrash. What is the connection between the medrash says it's a proof? Shinema. Here's a proof. What's the proof? The proof says the medrash is Kol Yemei Beit Elokim B'Shilo. What's the proof? This whole approach for us is very important because it radically changes how we understand the story. What's the connection?
Somewhere in Yud Chet.
So this pasuk is the end of Perek Yud Chet, which is the end of the story. Right? The story ends here. It's the last reference. This pestle, which was started in Perek Yud Zayin, which Shevet Dan stole and took up north, stood in Shevet Dan in the north all the days that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh. How does that tell me that this story is 300 years out of place?
Do we know already that some of this is out of chronological order?
So far, nothing's been out of chronological order. In
but somehow we know that.
No, the Medrash is telling me this verse is my proof.
That's what he's saying.
That's my point. I want to understand the proof. How does this verse tell me that this story is 300 years out of place? There are other proofs we're going to add to the picture in a moment. But this verse is the first hint, says the Medrash.
Something going back with Shiloh?
Shiloh.
It has to do with something with Shiloh, right?
Shiloh.
Yes.
Let's talk about Shiloh for a second. Something what is Shiloh? That's where the Mishkan was, right? Mishkan is the place of the Mishkan. Shiloh is the place of the Mishkan. The Beit HaLakim to which we are referring to here, of course, is the Mishkan. So all the days that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh, that's the time that Pesel Micha stood in Shevet Dan. Agreed?
Yeah.
How long, when was the Mishkan put in Shiloh?
After Yeshua came over and sometimes after they crossed the river.
Correct. Yeshua Perek Yud Chet, which is the end of the 14 years of conquest and division of the land. One of the last things that Yeshua does before he dies, he moves the Mishkan from Gilgal to Shiloh. And there it stays. So when Sefer Shoftim begins, where is the Mishkan?
In Shiloh.
How long does the Mishkan stay in Shiloh?
400 years, a little less than 400 years.
369. Very good. 369 years it stays in Shiloh. How do we get to 369 years? It's a complicated calculation which we at some point or another looked at, but we will look at again at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. When is the Mishkan? What causes the Mishkan to depart Shimshon? Shiloh.
The sons of Eli take it to war, use it
they
for
something. They take the Aron to war.
Yeah. And then
when is the when? What causes the Mishkan to be destroyed? Or when do we find the fall of Shiloh, let's call it?
Don't they build idols?
No, they're a tear. Aren't they both the Plishtim, no?
We know Plishtim took it, but...
Shmuel Aleph Perek Dalet is the great battle with the Plishtim. It's the first major war with the Plishtim in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. It's that battle with the Plishtim that Hophni and Pinchas take the Aron out of the Mishkan in order to fight, in order to win the war. They end up losing the Aron to the Plishtim. There is no reference in Sefer Shmuel directly to the destruction of the Mishkan and Shiloh. But there is reference in Sefer Tehillim and other places that make reference to this battle as the fall of Shiloh. It's pretty clear because in that battle, the Plishtim reach all the way up to northern tip of Har Ephraim. That's essentially where the Mishkan is destroyed. When we begin Sefer Shmuel, one of the questions we're going to explore in detail is why the fall of Mishkan, the fall of Shiloh, is not referred to in Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Shmuel. Right? It takes place at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. For some reason, the fall of the Mishkan, which was their equivalent of Tisha B'Av for all intents and purposes, mm-hmm. is omitted from Sefer Shmuel. We have hints to it, allusions to it. The Aron is captured, the Plishtim. There's a battle, there's a counter battle. The Mishkan then, the Aron never comes back to Shiloh. When the Aron comes back after its sojourn amongst the Plishtim, they put it in Kiryat Yerim, they put it in other places. It never goes back to Shiloh. It's unclear as to why. The clearest answer is that Mishkan Shiloh was destroyed in that battle. There's no reference to it explicitly in Sefer Shmuel. But that essentially is where it takes place. Okay? What is the time frame between Shimshon, which is the story just before Pesach Micha, and the beginning of Sefer Shmuel? Remember, now let's go back to Yiftach and Shimshon. If you remember our introduction to Shimshon, we suggested that Yiftach and Shimshon are actually happening in parallel to each other. Remember that conversation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The introduction to Yiftach is the introduction to both Yiftach and Shimshon. Yiftach in the east, Shimshon in the south. In Yiftach we have reference to 300 years from the time that they came into the land of Israel. So given the story of Yiftach and the story of Shimshon, add to Shimshon the 40 years, give or take, maybe they overlap, or 20 years, that they overlap. So Sefer Shoftim as a whole, the period of time that Sefer Shoftim covers, from the beginning, like Neoban Knaz, until the end, Yiftach and Shimshon, give or take is what, 320 years,
340,
340, depending on how you calculate. Some of them can overlap, but Yiftach makes reference to 300 years. The Mishkan stands in Shiloh for 369 years, which means that the total amount of time from Shimshon to, from the end of Shimshon to the destruction of the Mishkan in Shiloh, give or take, is approximately, I'm going to erase all of this. Give or take is approximately less than 50 years. Less than 50 years. Agreed?
Yes.
And into that time frame that Pasuk says that Pesel Micha stood in Shevet Dan until they went into exile, and the Pesel stood all the days of the Mishkan in Shiloh. Kol Yimei Beit HaElokim b'Shiloh. If the entire discussion is about 50 years or less, I'm not sure that the phrase, all the days that the Mishkan stood in Shiloh, is an appropriate phrase. the phrase all the days of the Mishkan stood in Shiloh sounds like this Pesel stood in Pesel in Shevet Dan for hundreds of years in parallel to the Mishkan in Shiloh. Here, this, the Mishkan in Shiloh, Bnei Yisrael is supposed to go there. And up north, I've got an idolatrous center of a temple to Shevet Dan called Pesel Micha. All the days of the Mishkan in Shiloh. So Chazal took the phrase Ko Yemei literally. And suggested, therefore, that the story of Pesel Micha has to be early enough to be contemporary to the entire history of the Mishkan and Shiloh. To do that, I have to take the story out of its place and I have to move it chronologically to the very first generation of Sefer Shoftim. You follow what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I do that, then I have to reinterpret certain phrases. I have to reinterpret the phrase by Mimahem. I have to reinterpret the phrase by Ein Melech B'Yisrael. So, take a look, for example, in Rashi. And by the way, before I do Rashi, the last four words of source number two, which is the Medrash, U'biyamav hayta pilegesh begiva. There are extras right here.
No,
we're in the source page. B'yamav hayta pilegesh begiva. Says the Medrash that whatever dating we put to Pesel Micha, we're going to have to put the same date to Pilegesh Begiva. Why? Why did the Medrash assume that whatever dating we give to Pesel Micha, we're going to give to the story that comes after Pilegesh Begiva? There is no connection between them because of the textual reference to Bayamim Mahem Ein Melech B'Yisrael. The two stories are linked by that phrase.
They always stand alone.
The two stories are textually linked. I showed you the chart in the middle of that other page. They're textually linked. I have this phrase that begins and ends the story of Pesel Micha, begins and ends the story of Pilegesh Begiva. They form a single literary unit in Sefer Shoftim. So whatever I do to date Pesel Micha, I will date Pilegesh Begiva. There are very few points of reference that will give us clear indication of dates within the stories themselves. We are reaching for straws. But that's the only thing we have. Says Rashi, Vahi Ish Mehar Ephraim. Who is this Ish Mehar Ephraim? Says Rashi, Afal Pish Nechtav Shtei Parshiot Halalu B'Sof HaSefer. Even though these two stories appear at the end of the book, which two stories are we referring to?
Pesel
Micha and Pilegesh Begiva. He says Pesel Shal Micha V'Shal Pilegesh Begiva. Nonetheless, B'Tchilat HaShoftim Haya B'Yimei Otniel Ben Knas. They actually occurred at the beginning in the days of Otniel ben Knaz. Rashi's translated the Kushan Mishataim reference in the Medrash to the Shofet reference of Otniel ben Knaz, but it's the same story. Shenemar ve'esimu lem et Pesel Micha ko yemei v'heyot bet alakim b'shilo lamadnu sheko yemei shilo haya dmut shel Micha. The two stories, the Mishkan in Shiloh and the dmut, the Pesel of Micha, exist simultaneously for the entire period of time. Rashi quotes an additional proof text, which is the story of Pilegesh Begiva. We haven't read this story or learned the story yet. There's a reference to the city of Yerushalayim, known as Yevus, which in that story is described as an ear of De Kochavim. At this point in time, Yerushalayim has been conquered and probably settled. It's hard to refer to Yerushalayim as an ear Yevus, as an ear Nochri, although that proof is less conclusive for us. All right, that's Rashi. Says the Radak. Source number three on the other side of the page. Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael. What's the weakness, before I do the Radak, what's the weakness in this interpretation? Besides the fact that I have to take an entire story and move it out of
sequence.
What's the textual weakness here?
The word melech.
Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael. The story begins with a reference to Bayamim ahem, and a reference to Ein Melech.
But if Melech is Shofet, you had a Shofet.
If Melech is Shofet, they had a Shofet.
Oh, you had a
Right? So we have to see what the reference here is. That's correct. That's why these two phrases are the weakness of this interpretation. Says the Radak. Bayamim Ahem, Gam ze pasuk mochiach ki lo haya ze bimeot niyo ben knas. This pasuk of Bayim Mehem en Malchus Yisrael is proof that this story did not take place in the days of Niyo ben Knas. Medak argues with Rashi. It's the other school of thought. That's why it's on the other side of the page. Ki shofet haya li Yisrael. Because in the days of Niyo ben Knas we had a shofet. It's not only from the phrase Ein Melech. Think about the implication. Adina, you mentioned this at the beginning of the discussion. Ish Yeshab Ben Avi Yaseh means anarchy. If you have a shofet, you don't have anarchy. You have authority, you have control. You have a shofet. That's what a shofet was. As it says, V'oshiyah miyadoi v'hem koi me'a shofet. V'yomer v'ayah b'mot ha-shofet yeshuva v'yishkitu mi'avotam. They were loyal to God the days of the shofet. Only after the shofet did they abandon God. As long as there was a shofet, they would not be described as anarchist. These three stories. What are the three stories? Bidvar Micha. Ubidvar Bnei Dan. He sees that as a second story. Ubidvar Pilegish Begiva. In these three stories, Amar Ein Melech B'Yisrael. These three stories are chronologically in place. Post Shimshon, pre Eli. Shaya, and Eli was also a shofet. Shaya shofet li Yisrael. Vayazman beinehem, the time in between, kemo shaya shelo haya lehem shofet, was a time without a shofet, and therefore a time of Ish Yeshar ben Av Yaseh. Says the Radak, that the story is an exact chronological sequence, meaning, if the story is an exact chronological sequence, it means that we go from Yiftah to Shimshon to Pesel Micha to Dan to Shim to Pilegesh to Eli. The difference is that these are Shoftim. And these are not. So Bayamim Ahem, in those days between Shimshon and Eli, there was no Ein Melech. But Ein Melech means Ein Shofet. So here's the core textual difference between the Radak and Rashi. Translate the word Melech in this pasuk according to each. According to Rashi, the word Melech means Melech, and Melech is different from a Shofet. According to Radak, the word Melech is equivalent to Shofet. It means some sort of leader, ruler, political authority, control. Ein Shofet, Ein Melech, it all means the same thing. And because Ein Shofet, meaning Ein Melech, this is what happened, post-Shimshon. If it means Melech literally, as Rashi suggests, then it's referring to a period of time at the very beginning where I have Shoftim, but I don't have Melech. You understand, of course, that the message of the story is fundamentally different according to each. According to Radak, what's the message of the story? If you lead Bnei Yisrael without leadership, this is what they're going to degenerate into.
And there wasn't even a shofet.
It wasn't just shofet, there was nothing. And therefore the story is simply along the sequence of Shoftim. I went from Yiv to Shimshon, and then from Shimshon to Pilegesh Begibah, from there to Eli, and I just continue along in sequence.
But from the beginning, it's because of the different interpretations or definition of Melech, that from the very beginning there's a controversy. Or there's the issue. How are we going to read this from the beginning, correct? It's not like we're going to start it and then you say, oh, there's... Some say there were no Melachim, some say there were no Shofet. Right?
What do you mean from the beginning?
I mean, when we start... Had you started this?
No. Beginning of the book?
No, now.
Right.
Yeah. There are issues from this point.
Right.
Yeah, according to Rashi, if I'm understanding what you're saying, is according to Rashi's interpretation, the story here is not about a period of time in which I have anarchy and no control and no leadership. That's not the subject of the story. According to the Radak, the subject is there's no leadership, there's nothing, there's anarchy, ish yeshar ben aviyaseh. According to Rashi, it's got nothing to do with anarchy. We'll come back to the phrase ish yeshar ben aviyaseh. That's a phrase we're going to have to understand much later. But it's got nothing to do with anarchy. What does it have to do with? It has to do with the definitional role distinction between a shofet and a melech. And what the story is telling me is, go back to the entire story of Sefer Shoftim, go back to the very beginning, and you want to understand what happened here, you have to understand that in this period of history, Bemi Mahem, we had Shoftim and not Melachim. Bemi Mahem and Melech, only Shoftim. You want to understand the story? The implication? Here are two stories to give you a good picture as to what it means to have a Shofet and not a Melech. In other words, according to Radak, the story is insignificant in and of itself, but it's not as broad in its message as Rashi's interpretation. To Rashi's interpretation, this story and its corollary and its follow-up of Pilegesh Begiva are fundamental. They're summaries of the core issues of all of Sefer Shoftim and serve as a segue into Sefer Shmuel. Because Sefer Shmuel is all about the establishment of the melech instead of the shofet, in lieu of the shofet. So I can't get to an understanding of what the need for a melech is until I establish what failed in the institution of the shofet. Says Rashi, that's what the story is about. And that's the answer to your question as to why it's here. It's here, according to Rashi's interpretation, as an epilogue to the story, as a kind of a bridge. We finished the period of shoftim. We finished it with Shimshon. Mm-hmm. It went out with a whimper.
These are like addenda to the story.
This is an addenda. This is a postscript. This is an epilogue. This is a bridge to, okay, now let's talk about what happened here in Sefer Shoftim and how it transitions into Sefer Shmuel. And given the fact that Sefer Shoftim was written by Shmuel HaNavi, who was the Navi who appoints the first king of Israel, not surprising, says Rashi, that this story is your key to understanding the difference between Melech and Shofet. So I put that out there as an introduction. And the reason it's an introduction is because we're not going to understand it until we finish learning Pesel Micha and Pilagish Begiva. And when we finish studying both of these stories, we'll have a much better understanding of what failed in the period of the Shofet, kind of a summary to the whole book, and therefore the need to change that model of leadership as we move into Sefer Shmuel.
How does anyone, or how did we decide which way we're going to look?
That's our next assignment.
See, I think
that's our next assignment. What is the textual proofs supports for each of these two positions, and therefore how are we going to approach this story? That's exactly what we are about to embark on in the remaining 20 minutes to us. I want to look at exactly the question that you just asked. Yeah. Sorry, Faye, what did you say?
I was concurring with Adina.
Right.
I just find it mind-boggling.
Two very different perspectives on the story, Rashi and Radak. It's not an accident that we have multiple mefarshim. We have multiple mefarshim because they looked at things differently, both philosophically and textually. Textual evidence, which weighs in more? Here I have a phrase, Kol Yimei Beit HaLel Kim Bishilo. Does that weigh in more with Rashi's interpretation or with Radak's interpretation? To Rashi's interpretation, it's the core text to prove that this Pesel Micha had to have existed for more than 50 years, because it has to have existed in parallel to the Mishkan and Shiloh. Radak's not bothered by that phrase so much. How he interprets it, open to discussion. So let's first work with the Radak, then we'll come back to Rashi. What support is there for the, let's call it the late theory. An early theory and a late theory.
So do you have to know all these theories before you pick up any kind of source? I mean, you realize that.
You sort of learn them along the way,
no,
right?
I
you read Rashi, then you read Radak.
I mean for the individual, you have to realize that before you pick up a source, you got to know this.
Well, you have to work them through That's why you have to learn multiple times.
I think it works the other way. The sources sort of key you into the possibilities.
Correct.
Of what the...
That's what Chazal, that's why Medrash and Mefarshim are there. Because once I learn the text, I then have to go relearn it.
Right. The other way.
The other way. That's true with, it's true with all Mefarshim.
Okay. Now
that's true with all Mefarshim. one of the things that Nechama Leibowitz used to harp on all the time was that any time you read a parish, doesn't make a difference what parish it is, the most important thing to do after you finish reading it is to go back to the text and reread or retranslate or repunctuate or re-understand the text according to the nuance, the new nuance that this parish has introduced. So in this case, it's an interpretation of the word melech. They're fundamentally different. So let's talk about the Radak for a moment, the late theory. Support for the Radak. What support is there for the Radak's theory that this story is late? Story meaning post, that it's in chronological order.
Excuse me, Valerie, one more thing. Mm-hmm. When we finish and go begin Shmuel, will we be able to come to conclusion?
We're going to come to a conclusion before then.
Oh, we will?
I'm hoping, time permitting, we're going to come to a conclusion today. I have a strong bias in between these two interpretations. So I'll share that bias with you. That's right. I'll share that bias with you.
Thank you for sharing.
So first, let's talk about the Radak.
He's more textual. So
in what way is he more textual?
If you say that's a shofet or a leader, that he's going by when there was a leader and when there wasn't a leader.
So for the Radak, you have to assume that the word melech equals the word shofet. That's both a strength and a weakness. Because Rashi can argue, Melech is one word and Shofet is another word. How did you jump them together? Melech appears in Sefer Shmuel, Shofet appears in Sefer Shoftim. Since when did you get the assumption that they're synonymous with each other?
We've spoken about this before.
Right. According to Rashi, Shofet is not equal to Melech. Okay. So that's not going to necessarily help me, per se. What other textual support, or philosophical support, is there for the Radak?
Didn't you say the word Kol Yemei?
Kol Yemei is here. Oh. Kol Yemei Beit Elokim B'Shilo. That's support for Rashi. Because the reference to the Mishkan and Shilo as all the days of sounds like it's more than 50 years. That's for Rashi. I need to put something on this side of the board. Otherwise, the poor Adak is out here standing alone.
Well, you must side better with him, right? You can put your name up there.
Where does this do you
have? Bayim Mehem. According to the Radak, what does Bayim Mehem mean?
After
Shimshon.
Before.
And given the fact that there's no textual indication that we've shifted time frames, I would have read it initially, intuitively, when we first read the story. Did we suggest that Bayim Mehem means 300 years earlier?
No.
We saw Bayim Mehem as post Shimshon. You have to go some to be able to say that Bayim Mehem means the whole book of Shoftim. Right? That requires creativity. Says the Radak, no, Bayim Mehem means in order. There's another philosophical issue here, which is less textual, and that is the general attitude to the to shifting stories chronologically in Tanakh. That's a whole philosophical school of thought. Rashi is much more willing to move stories chronologically from their location based on Midrashic sources than other Mefarshim are. So the Radak is generally hesitant to apply the phrase in Mukta Malukha. Doesn't like it so much. I mean, he likes it, it's sometimes necessary, but not arbitrarily. What else? Anything else?
Well, that's pretty strong on Rashi's side, you know, to say...
We haven't gotten to Rashi's side. We're still at the Radak side.
Yeah, but I mean...
But Adina clearly has a side. What is your point
never
for Rashi?
We're going to get to Rashi in a second. Hold it, because I'm going to get to Rashi. Right, Radak, anything else for Radak? Anything else for the Radak? Poor Radak. All right. Left out in the cold here. The only other suggestion I would make to support the Radak in this regard is that the depth of the moral deprivation described in these two stories, Pesach Micha and Erech B'Kiva together, is so intense. It's hard to swallow that this is where we're at the very beginning, one generation after Yeshua. We're talking about a civil war that nearly wipes out all of Shevet Binyamin and Pelag Erech B'Kiva. We're talking about group rape. We're talking about idolatry. We're talking about a culture of idolatry that which is so foreign to Jewish values. Elohim asher asiti lakachtem, or God whom I had made, you stole. The whole notion of idolatry here is so intense that to suggest that this is one generation after Yehoshua is possible, certainly, but I would say I like to call it the omekache, the depth of the sin here, is really appropriate for having gone through the cycle 15 times and now we hit rock bottom. It's hard to use those two examples as an indication of where we were a generation after Yehoshua.
Is this one of the worst rock bottoms?
In the description of the chet, we've never had a description of the chet. We've only had this generic, esoteric, Israel did evil in the eyes of God.
Right.
We've never seen what it means. What Rashi essentially says is that here's two stories to understand what we've been dealing with for 300 years. Why did God get so angry at Bnei Yisrael so many times? Because here's two paradigm stories. They're paradigmatic to the whole period of time. Essentially is what Rashi is suggesting.
It was just bad.
But according to the Radak, it's getting worse each time, and this is rock bottom. Okay. Yeah. So let's deal with Rashi. To Rashi's suggestion that we have there are another couple of references that are very important for us to understand the nature of the chronology here. One, I think, is the reference to the structure. I talked about this last week, the structure of Vayimahem en Melech B'Yisrael. That structure, that phrase that sets apart this whole section from the rest of Sefer Shoftim, introduces Sefer Pesach Micha, introduces Parshat Dan, introduces Peleg Erech B'Kiva, concludes the Sefer. That phrase is so intense that it appears four times in exactly the same way in a kind of chiastic structure on two stories, really takes these two stories and sets them apart from the rest of the book from a literary point of view. So the suggestion that they are actually separate chronologically is very compelling based on the fact that what these two texts, these two stories do, what this textual structure does, is it says, okay, here's a summary of the whole period of time. But it goes beyond that. Let's go back to the Shiloh reference. Remember, Yeshua puts the Mishkan in Shiloh in chapter 18, very early. In Sefer Yeshua, the reference to the Mishkan is a constant theme of Sefer Yeshua. They're always going back to the Mishkan. They go back to the camp in Gilgal. Every time they go back, they're camped around the Mishkan. In fact, if you remember our discussion 4 years ago, that was a long time ago. Why did Yeshua move the Mishkan to Shiloh? He moved it to Shiloh because they were constantly going back to base camp in Gilgal, and he wanted them to start settling the land that they were entitled to or obligated to go to. So he broke camp and he moved the Mishkan to Har Ephraim. And he said, this is it, go, scatter, be gone. And that was part of the philosophy. We have now been through 16 chapters in Sefer Shoftim, where in Sefer Shoftim is the Mishkan in Shiloh mentioned.
Is it?
When Hanukkah
300 years plus to Sefer Shoftim. 300 years plus to Sefer Shoftim. Think about it.
Sure,
you are correct. Sefer Shmuel opens with the Mishkan. And Sefer Shmuel, you can't walk 3 inches in Sefer Shmuel without encountering some reference to the Mishkan, the Aron, the Shechina, something. It's a core theme of the whole book. Sefer Shoftim, what Where is the last time the Mishkan and Shiloh were mentioned? Even the name Shiloh. Even the name of the city. We're talking about 300 years of religious / political leadership. The reference to the Mishkan, Mikdash, something in the course of the stories that we have encountered. And what's astounding is that Faye is correct. What's astounding is that there is no reference to the Mishkan. Or did Shelley say it? Somebody said that.
I didn't say
right.
It.
But it was a leading question.
Right.
It was a leading question. Don't.
You're brilliant.
And that's really remarkable. It's remarkable. You have 300 years of history and no reference to the Mishkan. No reference to Aliyah LeRegel, no reference to Korbanot, no reference to Avoda, no reference. All you have is this constant theme of their serving God. The only hint you have is to a passing as euphemistic reference of they worshipped idols and they didn't worship God. Or they abandoned God. Which we could understand to mean that they're worshipping idols means they're not going to the Mishkan and Shiloh. But it doesn't explicitly tell me anything about the Mishkan. Until two stories, two episodes in which suddenly the Mishkan appears. Pilegish Pesel Micha is the first. Koyeme Beit Elokim B'Shilo. And the second is Pilegish B'Kiva. And what happened by Pilegish B'Kiva? And remember, the textual suggests, the structure, by Mimahim and Melech B'Yisrael, everybody agrees that these two stories are chronologically linked.
Right.
So whatever I do with one, I have to do with the other. And if one drags me back to the early part of the book, then the other is going to as well. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, let me shift your focus to Pilegish B'Kiva for a second. Pilegish B'Kiva, which we have not learned, we have not looked at, except for passing references here and there. Pilegish B'Kiva is a really, if you've learned it at all, no, it's really a horrible story. It's kind of like stomach-turning, but it's about all kinds of issues. But it concludes with a great civil war. It's right. The primary focus of the story is the pretext that leads to a great civil war between the tribes of Israel and Shevet Binyamin. In that description of the war, Perek Chaf. Perek Chaf. Starting with Pasuk Yud Chet. They're all ready for war. Pasuk Yud Zayin. They're all ready for war. Ve'ish Yisrael hitpakdu levad mi-Binyamin. All of Israel together against Binyamin. 400,000 soldiers in the allied camp of the tribes of Israel against the camp of Binyamin. Ve'yakumu ve'ya'alu Beit El. Ve'yish'alu be'elokim. They go to Beit El to seek God. Now, what do you do when you go to seek God? What are you asking? When you're about to go to war and you seek God?
Victory.
You're asking for God's blessing, but in this case, who do you turn to for that advice? What does it mean to when you're about to go to war, you go to the Beit Elokim and you seek God?
You make an offering.
Right? You're seeking a message from God as to whether or not you will be victorious, you go to battle. Who are you going to?
The Kohen
Gadol, correct. Vayomru b'nei Yisrael mi'yaleh lanu b'tchilah l'milchamah b'nei Binyamin. Question, who should go first to war against Binyamin? Vayomer Hashem Yehuda b'tchilah. And God answered Yehuda first. How did God answer? Remember the story of the Medrash? The best point in the names of the tribes? Okay. They're in the... In other words, where are they? They're in the Mishkan. They're talking to the Kohen Gadol. In what city? So here it's referred to as Beit El. And the Mefarshim actually split whether they're in some kind of temporary camp, Kohen Gadol-centered camp in Beit El, or, as most Mefarshim understand, Beit El here is a reference to Shiloh, which was referred to as Beit El because it was the place in which the Mishkan stood.
Was.
So here they're in Shiloh. They go to war the first time around, and they lose the first campaign in this battle. Not our issue for now. They come back to God in or to the Mishkan in Pasuk of Gimel. Ve'yalu b'nei Yisrael ve'yivku lifnei Hashem ad ha'erev ve'yishalu b'Hashem lemor ha'osif l'keshel l'milchama b'nei Binyamin achi. They seek God's advice a second time. Should I go to battle? And God says, Alu elav, go, and you will succeed. Ve'yikrevu b'nei Yisrael el b'nei Binyamin b'nei Hashem. Second time around, and they again are defeated. They come back to the Mishkan, Pasuk Vav. Vayalu kol bnei Yisrael v'chol ha'am v'yavo Beit El. Again, Beit El / Mishkan Shiloh. Vayivku. Vayishvu sham lifnei Hashem. Vayatsumu b'yamahu ad ha'erev. Vayalu olot u'shlamim lifnei Hashem. They fast, they bring in korbanot. Suddenly we're into the world of korbanot. Where are they? Beit El. Okay, so we have to assume that Beit El means the Mishkan and Shiloh. Vayishalu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem, b'sham Aron Brit Elokim b'yamim ahem. That's where the Aron was. So if I mean to say that Beit El is a different city, that means that somehow I have this makeshift alternative Mishkan set up here, which is very problematic. So that's why Mefarshim said that this is Mishkan Chiddush in Mishkan Shiloh is the Aron Brit Elokim. Not only that, not only do I have the Kohen Gadol and the Aron. What else do I have here? Ufinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon omed lefanav bayamim mahem. You have a Kohen Gadol. And who is the Kohen Gadol? Who is the Kohen Gadol? In the story of Kilagesh Begiva, Finchas ben Elazar ben Aharon. That's a familiar face to us.
Mm-hmm.
Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron. We know who Pinchas is. It's the same Pinchas ben Aaron HaKohen, who at that point in time is the Kohen Gadol. Now, according to the Radak, this story is 300 years after Yeshua. So how do we end with Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron?
Shouldn't be around.
I've got a 300-year-old Kohen Gadol.
He's old.
That's not a problem, says the Radak. You know why? Because Chazal tell us that who is Pinchas? Pinchas, who? Eliyahu. So Pinchas is Eliyahu, says Radak, it's not a problem. Eliyahu is 1,000 years after Yeshua, or 800 years, 700 years after Yeshua. So if Pinchas can live for 700 years, he can certainly live 300 years. Eliyahu is eternal. Not a problem.
That was my idea of Radak, because it seemed like Radak was more of the rational type.
Right. However, if I work off the assumption that Pinchas is Pinchas, Eliyahu is Eliyahu, and they could be linked thematically and personality-wise and purpose and etc., but not necessarily as a 700-year-old Navi, then the reference to Pinchas in Pilagish Begiva means that I'm talking about a generation after Elazar, one generation after Yeshua, would put me into the world of Otniel ben Knaz. Achi Kalev, a katan mimenu. It's a generation after Yeshua and Kalev. And one generation later, we're talking about Pinchas. If we're talking about Pinchas in Pilegesh Begivra, do you remember what I said to you at the end of last week's class? In Pesach Micha, I have reference to the Kohen Gadol, I have reference to a Levi. And who is my famous Levi? Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. The Chazal, which we'll see next week, remove the letter Nun from his name,
right.
And suggest that the Levi is Moshe's grandson.
Oh yeah, you said.
And we asked, and I left you with this as a hanging question: how did Chazal find Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson in the story? The answer is it's very easy. If they found Aaron's grandson in the story,
then
they can find Moshe's grandson in the story. And I have two stories. One focuses around Aaron's grandson Pinchas, and the other focuses around Moshe's grandson Yonatan. That, I think, ultimately is the most compelling part of the chronological proof, and that is essentially the approach that we are going to use to understand Pesach Micha, the approach of Rashi and the Medrash, that this story is early, and it's a paradigmatic summary of the whole period of Sefer Shoftim.
Okay, so